South Florida's new congressman, Miami-Dade College's new president, and a local filmmaker on finding new heroes. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Carlos Jimenez is about to start his new role as a representative of South Florida in Washington. We'll ask him about his thoughts on governing as a congressman, battling COVID now, and his legacy as mayor. Also, an update on COVID cases in public schools across South Florida, and a look at the new Miami-Dade College president. Finally,
it's a lot of litter in this neighborhood, and y'all want to live in a dirty neighborhood? I don't like that. I want to change that.
We'll meet Miamian filmmaker Dorian Emerson about his new short, Negros. It's an uplifting story of a local boy from Liberty City who wants to clean up his neighborhood. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, one of the many new faces on Capitol Hill in January will be a familiar face in Miami-Dade County. Republican Carlos Jimenez was elected to Miami-Dade's 26th congressional district, defeating incumbent Democrat Debbie McCarcel Powell. The race was one of the most expensive nationwide, millions of dollars spent by both parties. For close to a decade, Jimenez served as Miami-Dade County's mayor, and over that tenure, the county has seen dramatic transformations in the economy, the environment, and of course, over the past year, the health of its citizens. Congressman-elect Jimenez, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. How are you doing today?
It's safe, and that's about as best as I can say, so I'm good. I'm glad that I can say that. By the way, I just want to mention that if you do have a question for the congressman-elect, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. You know, sir, you're entering Congress as coronavirus cases are rising nationwide, the economy is struggling, and there's a lot of political divisiveness. Why did you want this job?
I want to continue to serve, and I wanted to continue to serve in a different environment, more on a national scale. I think that I can bring my wealth of experience as a local political leader to Washington to help solve local problems at the federal level.
You heard in the newscast just before this. I mean, they were talking about a lot of people out of work. Rents are due. A lot of people, evictions are up. Unemployment is still up. And of course, we're still dealing with the pandemic. What is your greatest priority?
Well, my greatest priority is what I said in the campaign was restoring the economy. We have to restore the economy. We have to take a look and see if we can do another stimulus package, but one that really is focused on the negative effects of this pandemic on individuals, on businesses. We also have to keep an eye on the size of that stimulus package because at the end, you know, it's going to be our children and grandchildren who have to pay the interest and repay back whatever amount of money that we use for stimulus. So I want to make it as large as it needs to be, but as small also as it needs to be.
Do you have an idea of how big it should be?
Not right now. I think that the $3 trillion that was originally proposed was excessive. There were a lot of things in there that were not about the pandemic. They were about bailing out some states and counties and cities that had generated a lot of deficits in some of their programs. I mean, I think the Illinois pension system comes to mind. There are millions, if not hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in the red. Probably do some really bad decisions they made in the past. That's not something that has to do with a pandemic. Those are issues that have to deal with the pandemic. Those, the issues of businesses closing and people losing their jobs due to the pandemic, I'm more than willing to look at, and that's what we need to focus in on so that once this vaccine starts to be distributed and once we can get back to a normal, we can kickstart the economy and get it rolling again.
So what I'm hearing from you, it seems like it's about getting money directly to businesses and individuals.
Exactly. That's what I think we should do. We should also reimburse those states and local governments that actually were performing COVID-related functions. Take, for example, Miami-Dade County is still providing thousands of meals to elderly every single day to keep them safe. That is a COVID-related response that should be reimbursed, either through a new CARES Act funding or with FEMA funding. There is some federal reimbursement needs to be done for those localities and for those states that have done those kinds of programs to help keep people safe or to stimulate parts of their economy. That's certainly something I can support. But broader than that, it would be difficult for me to support. Things that happened in the past have nothing to do with COVID-19. Be very difficult for me to try to support something like that.
You mentioned pandemic a lot, so let's ask about this. And one of the things I was curious about is you pushed hard for masks and distancing, social distancing, mm-hmm. here in Miami-Dade. President-elect Joe Biden was talking about a national mask mandate. Is that necessary? Would you support that?
Well, I'm not even sure that that's something that he can enforce. I think a lot of it goes down to the state and the localities. When Governor DeSantis kind of eased up on some of the restrictions across the state and other areas, I understood that because there were some areas that were not, did not have the kind of numbers that we had in Miami-Dade County. He allowed us to keep that flexibility. And so I don't believe in a one-size-fits-all, approach. But, in those areas that have high numbers, I believe, like in Miami-Dade County, we kept the mask order throughout my time as mayor. We also kept curfews during my time as mayor, and some local cities in Miami-Dade decided they weren't going to enforce the curfew, but those orders were in place for the entire county. And so I believe that there should be some flexibility involved depending on the situation. But in the case of Miami-Dade, obviously we kept our mask order in place throughout my time as mayor.
But when you look at back in the summer, when we hit peak, mm-hmm. You saw the cases in big cities. And the argument was, well, in those small rural areas, not so much. But now you're seeing that the explosion of COVID in those rural areas. So shouldn't we just say, look, everybody, the whole country, so we can get a control of this, let's all do this?
Well, the problem is that there are places that have had the mask order in place for a long time, and we still had coming up and start spiking up.
Miami-Dade County. Yeah, it's not perfect.
Miami-Dade County is a good example of that. We had a mask order in place the whole time. We had curfew in place the whole time, and we're still seeing this thing spike. There is a normal progression to this virus that people just maybe don't want to understand. And we know that a virus peaks, it comes down, and then eventually it peaks again, and then it comes down, and there may be a third surge, later on if we don't have a vaccine. And so that's the normal progression of the virus. And so what we do is we try to keep the virus level, and we try to keep the infection level to a point where it never overwhelms the capacity of the health system in that locality, from being overwhelmed.
You think that masks have become politicized? I always think back to when you were mayor. Mm-hmm. Governor DeSantis would come down here, and too many times I'd see the two of you. You were almost always wearing your mask, as I could tell. Governor DeSantis was not always wearing his mask, and President Trump seldom wore his mask. Isn't it about messaging?
There's something to be said about messaging. And so, look, in my county, when somebody entered my county, I expected them to wear a mask. Okay, and so I understood the president. The president is a little different because actually the president got tested like every day. And then even if you were trying to get close to the president, you'd have to get tested. So there was a sense of security there. But that's not the case with the average individual. And so is it being politicized? Probably being politicized. I tried not to make it political. I was listening to the advice of my medical experts that said this is what we should be doing. And then that's what we did. In Miami-Dade County.
And I mean, and also to be clear, the president did contract COVID. So, but I just point that out. Now, we talk about the president. I have to ask you, because, again, you probably mm-hmm. heard it in the newscast. There are more Republicans now coming forward and acknowledging that President-elect Biden has won this election. Do you think that President Trump should concede and acknowledge this?
I think that the president needs to, he has a legal avenue, and I believe that anybody in the United States has the right to pursue those legal avenues, and the president should be given that right to pursue those legal avenues.
I have
no problem with the president pursuing that. Remember, back in 2000, Mr. Gore did not concede for over 30 days and pursued his legal
now,
options.
I
had no problem with that either.
That was that was a little bit different story because there were actual questions about what was going on with ballots. And in this case, you know what? All the states in question, from Pennsylvania to Wisconsin to Georgia, Republican leaders have said in those states, everything went smoothly. There were no problems. There is no fraud. All the court cases are being thrown out. But here's the biggest concern. You bring up that one, the 2000, is that transition of power could be a national security risk, because going back to that election, the 9/11 terrorist report came out and said that because of that delay, there could have been a national security gap in protecting the country from the 9/11 attacks. So isn't there a danger right now in not making the transition?
Listen, to be honest with you, that somehow that particular issue back in November of 2000, of the year 2000, somehow really had an effect on something that happened 9 months later. They couldn't catch up in 9 months on the briefings. I find that hard to believe, to be honest with you. Okay, and so the whoever the president is on January 20th, there's still over 2 months to go until that happens. And I've stated that when the national security interests, when the national security professionals say, hey, look, whoever, we don't know who's winning, but both people should be getting now the briefings. That's when it should start, when it should happen. And so if it comes to that, when they say, look, now we need to start briefing whoever it is on this, and if it has to be two, it has to be two, then I have no problems with those briefings being given to both people, or one, whoever it is that's deemed to be the next president.
Are you worried at all, though, that you have the president tweeting out? He's not saying, and you know how he does it, okay? He's saying there's fraud. He's making claims that even Republicans are saying that's not true. Isn't there a concern, Mr. Jimenez, that you're basically questioning our political system and destroying the confidence in that system?
I don't think that when you question anything, you're destroying anything. So if you question
the way he does it,
let me answer the question, okay? And so I don't believe that when you question anything, you're destroying anything. As a matter of fact, it is the job of the press to be skeptical. It's not the job of the press to take everything at face value. The last time I heard about the press. And so I look at things in a skeptical way. And so if you have nothing to hide, then you should have nothing to hide. There should be no problem in somebody questioning whether what you did was right or wrong. And then if it turns out that it was right, then that in itself, then it enhances the public's opinion and enhances the public's confidence in our electoral system. That All somebody right. is questioning it is, I actually have absolutely no problem, because I view my job in Congress as to be very skeptical and question everything. And then it turns out that this is the answer, then I will have confidence in what's happening here in Washington, D.C.
That's fine. I will say this, though, because you're talking about the press. The press did go to these states and did ask and did look. And again, officials within those states, from governors to legislatures to elections officials, some Republican, all said no fraud. There's nothing going on here. Everything worked exactly as we expected.
That'll be good. But you know what? There's also a legal process that it has. And okay. There's a little bit more in-depth investigations of what the press is privy to. And so I have absolutely no problem in people going into the weeds, finding out if there's anything wrong. And if they find out that there are things that were wrong, and maybe not enough to overturn the election, but whatever it is that they find wrong, we need to fix them. Because you know what? In Miami-Dade County, during our election processes, we always were tweaking our election system to make it better and better and better and better. And the only way that we did that is because there were people that were skeptical and were questioning, and how come it takes so long to get this results out? Why did we have so many people in line in the year 2012?
Florida.
Okay. And all of those things came about because people questioned what we were doing.
Right. And Florida fixed its problems. We had a very smooth election.
Exactly. I'm very proud of it. Okay, but you know what? I don't think that the rest of the country has the same system that we do. So I want to use our model, our system as the model of how we got things done right.
I have a lot of things I want to get to.
Go ahead.
Finish up.
Okay.
Finish up.
I have things I want to talk to too. Okay, and so we were very proud of the things that we did. So what did we do? We didn't mail out, you know, a million absentee ballots. We said, if you want one, you can go ahead and ask for one. And those people did. We had record number of people ask for mail-in ballots, absentee ballots. We have a certain way that we verify those ballots. We count them as they come in. So that's by 7:30 at night.
All right, let's not go over the
majority of those already counted, and so there was never a question.
I agree with you.
Let's
agree with you. Let's not go over the entire election. I understand. And you know what? I'll come back at you in a couple of years and see if maybe you've been able to implement our system across the country. Again, I'm talking with Congressman-elect Carlos Jimenez. Again, right. On District 26, he defeated incumbent Debbie McCarthy Powell. Again, you can read more of the reporting on the November elections on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I wanted to move to your time as mayor. Nearly a decade running the biggest county in the state, and a lot happened over that time. But I wanted to ask, what do you look back on as your greatest legacy?
I have a bunch, and there's a lot of them.
Give me the biggest one for you that you're most proud of.
The biggest legacy that I'm most proud of is the diversification of our economy. Also, one of the biggest ones that I have is also what we did with Liberty Square and the transformation of Liberty Square, those 52 acres that were crime-ridden, where people were living in really really terrible conditions, and we're completely redoing that when people said it couldn't be done. But there's so many things that we did that all really right. flew under the radar. That's going to be difficult for me to tell you, hey, what are the things I'm most proud of? I'm proud of all those things that we did.
Well, let's take it, because you talk about, for example, housing. Let's talk about affordable housing, still a critical need in this county.
Yeah.
You could talk about some of those projects like in Liberty City, but there are advocates who say, look, that's a drop in the bucket. Miami's not affordable, and it seems to be getting worse.
Well, one of the things that you have to do to combat that is actually to improve the economy. And so what we did is, when I became the mayor, we had an unemployment rate of about 12.5%. Before the pandemic, we got that down to about 1.8%. Median income also rose by 20% during my time as the mayor. All of that contributes to having affordable housing, because when people get better paying jobs, then they're able to get better housing. Is there an affordable housing issue in Miami-Dade County? Do we need more affordable housing? Without a doubt. But those things just aren't built overnight. And I'm really proud of what we have done with Director Michael Liu and his innovative programs to get more affordable housing stock, you know, up and running.
Talk about those higher paying jobs, but know, this is a service economy. What do you think about the minimum wage amendment that passed? Do you think that's going to help?
I think it's going to help, but also there's a double-edged sword with that. You know, hopefully that's going to be implemented over time, and it's something that can be implemented over time. But you have to be careful too that when you start putting a certain minimum wages above what employers can afford, then people start losing their jobs. That's the other side of that coin. Now, I think that the way this is done, I believe that amendment said that it would take up to 2026.
2026 for the $15 an hour, yes.
Exactly. So that allows the employers to start to account for that and able to implement that over a period of time. So I think that was reasonable, and that's the way things should be done. And so, that's part of it. But look, the best way to deal with a housing crisis is, like I said, through a good paying job. All right, increasing the wages. So that's why I said I was very proud of the 20% increase in median income during my time as mayor. The way that we diversified the economy during my time as mayor, it used to be a service economy. Again, you're interrupting me. I'm trying to make a point here.
No, I know, but I have to end it.
I know, but on this point,
I want to, because we're going to finish on this. On this point, again, it is a service economy. Do you think that we have to change the economy here? Housing has gone up. Even with the pandemic, you heard the numbers.
No.
Housing's actually going up.
Yeah, but one of the things that I did during my time as mayor is try to start to change from a service economy. That's what I talked about, diversifying the economy. All right, we become a tech center here in Miami during my time. We invested in that ecosystem so that we'd have more technology-driven jobs in Miami-Dade County, so we have more entrepreneurship in Miami-Dade County. When the Kauffman Foundation got us to be the number one city in the United States in terms of startups, all right, that was unheard of before my time as mayor. And all that was with an eye towards diversifying the economy, getting away from a service economy and more to a tech economy. And hopefully in the future, we can start to bring back some manufacturing to Miami-Dade County. But it's something that I couldn't get to in my short time as mayor.
and we have to end it there in a short time because you know how the show works. But you know what? Yeah. I gave you the last word. Again, Congressman-elect Carlos Jimenez, he takes office in January in Miami's District 26. Congratulations on the victory, sir. And I'm looking forward to having you back because there's a lot to talk about.
I like our back and forth. I really do. Okay. And I hope to be back. Whenever you want me back, I'll be back. Okay?
Absolutely. Congressman-elect Carlos Jimenez, thanks again.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, COVID cases in our public schools and a look at the new leader of Miami-Dade College, all coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. After a multi-year search, Miami-Dade College has selected a new president.
God is great, and America is great, because only could a daughter of Cuban immigrants dream today to be back at her alma mater, where she started as a basketball player, to lead Miami-Dade College.
Madeline Pumariega will take over for interim president Rolando Montoya in the spring, and the MDC graduate has her work cut out for her. The school has seen a massive drop in enrollment because of the pandemic. Its finances are being hit hard again because of the pandemic, and it's fighting to control this virus on the campus. Well, earlier this morning, we spoke with WLRN's education reporter Jessica Bakeman about the new president, and we also talked about the spread of COVID in public schools across South Florida.
So Madeline Pumariega is currently a top administrator at Tallahassee Community College, but before that, she's had some bigger positions. She's probably most notably the former chancellor of the Florida college system. So that's the whole statewide system that includes all of the community colleges, state colleges. And she's been really closely involved with the state legislature and people in Tallahassee who work on making education policy, which I think is one of the primary reasons they were interested in her, knowing that we're going into a period of time that's going to be very difficult financially for colleges. They wanted to have somebody who already has the contacts and sort of knows how to work, knows their way around Tallahassee. So she'll be able to advocate for the college to get through the financial difficulties.
Now she is from Hialeah. She went to MDC. She played basketball there. She taught there. She held a high position. Was she a given to get this position, or did she have tough competition?
Well, she definitely had competition. So, and you're right, before she was chancellor of the Florida college system, she worked at Miami-Dade College for about 2 decades, and she was president of the Wolfson campus, which is the downtown Miami campus at one point. And she does have that deep personal connection to Miami-Dade College, given that she's from here, given that she went to school there. So that definitely helps a lot. The Board of Trustees made it clear throughout the long process of trying to find the next president that they really wanted to make sure they had somebody who understood Miami. That being said, she was one of 4 finalists, and one of the other finalists is also someone who knows Miami well, who is the current provost of Miami-Dade College. Her name is Lenore Rodicio. So the provost is the second in command. And Lenore Rodicio had the support of former President Eduardo Padron and also the support of Rolando Montoya, who was the interim president who served while they were doing the search. And there were definitely some people who were, you know, hoping to see her get the job. I think at the end of the day, it came down to the fact that Madeline Pumariega has those connections in Tallahassee, and they felt that that was, you know, the priority.
Obviously, she's a different person than Padron, but do we get a sense of how different she is and how she'll govern differently than he did?
I don't think she'll govern so differently in any particular way. I think that she is talking a lot about how the college grew so much under the quarter century that Eduardo Padron was president, and she hopes to continue to see that growth take place. She also talked about, you know, Miami-Dade College being the engine of the economy here and the engine of economic recovery in Miami-Dade County as we come out of this COVID situation. So I think that will be her focus getting started, is how can Miami-Dade College help the community recover? And part of that is, you know, a lot of times when there's an economic downturn, people will go back to school because they need to, maybe they lost their job and they want to get some more skills so that they can get a better job. And that's one thing that I know she wants to focus on.
Yeah, I wondered if, like, what are a couple of, like, the things that she'd like to implement? And obviously, on top of all that, she's going to deal with COVID.
Right. So she talked about this a little bit during her interview process. A lot of what she mentioned was how to make the online learning experience better, you know, assuming that we're going to be contending with that still for quite a while. Having that situation be so that students really feel engaged, so that the classes that they're taking online feel personalized and like they're really getting something out of it. So she really wants to focus on that, and also focusing on, she talked about virtual internships and trying to figure out how can we take that sort of workforce training component that can be difficult to do virtually or remotely and make that better going into the future.
We're talking with WLRN education reporter Jessica Bakeman, talking about Miami-Dade College's new president. We're also going to talk to her about COVID cases now spreading throughout South Florida public schools. All right, talking about COVID, I want to switch over and talk about public schools. And, well, cases are up nationwide, but what do we know about what's happening in the public schools here in the area?
Right now, I'm looking at the dashboards in Miami-Dade, 708 cases total. In Broward, 505 cases. In Palm Beach, 690 cases. And then in the Keys, it's around 50, between 50 and 60 cases. They've been kind of doing this dance the last 6 weeks or so where, you know, a case is reported, and then because of contact tracing, they find out, okay, the student or the teacher who was positive was in touch with these people. And so maybe we have to quarantine a classroom or we have to quarantine a school. And so there have been students who, even though they are going to school in person, have maybe been back at home for a couple of weeks and then headed back to school. So it's a little bit chaotic. It's definitely a very difficult situation, and the school districts are trying to work their way through it.
So Miami-Dade Superintendent Alberto Carvalho wants to reconvene the Public Health and Medical Expert Task Force. They had a school board meeting yesterday. Is there a conversation about possibly shutting school down again?
Yeah, I think that conversation is starting to happen. It's a difficult situation because if you think about how, you know, when a lot of other school districts in the state reopened in the fall, South Florida school districts waited in part because we were hit hardest by the summer surge of COVID-19 cases. And the school districts had their own criteria for what needed to happen in order for them to feel like it was safe to open schools. And some of those criteria are no longer, you know, in place, or they're, you know, headed in a direction where soon they won't be. So for example, in Miami-Dade, they said, okay, well, we'll reopen schools if we have a sustained COVID-19 positivity rate of less than 10% and trending toward 5% for 2 weeks. And, you know, right now we're looking at a 7 or 8% positivity rate, and it's going up. So that is not trending toward 5%. And again, just as a reminder, the positivity rate is the percentage of people in a given day who get tested, what percentage of them are positive. So the higher the positivity rate there is, that signals that there's more widespread transmission of the virus. They also wanted, the Miami-Dade School District also wanted to see a steady reduction in the number of individuals hospitalized, a sustained ICU bed occupancy, that to be going down. So fewer people to be in the ICU, fewer people to be hospitalized. And of course, those are going in the other direction now. So I think there is a real argument for resuming that conversation about whether to close schools. I just spoke with a Broward County school board member who said she wants to see that conversation happen in Broward, but both school districts are facing a lot of pressure from the governor and the education commissioner, who both want to see schools remain open and have said that they, you know, the governor has said he wishes schools had never closed because he thinks that the cons of that outweigh the pros. So we'll see.
And meanwhile, New York City schools Now back to virtual classes. State Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran announced that he plans to extend the executive order requiring schools offer in-person classes. But what is going forward? They're going to have a legislative session in a few months. You know, what is that pressure going forward? And who really has the upper hand? I mean, can the state say to Alberto Carvalho, you're going to stay open? Or can the district say, no, we're not going to do that?
So this is a fundamental question that has been really at the center of this whole debate over school reopening. So on paper, in our state constitution, school boards, our local elected officials, they have the authority over the schools in their districts. However, the state has control over the funding. And so we already saw this play out in that Miami-Dade and Broward both wanted to open later than Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran and the state wanted to see them open in the beginning of October, which is ultimately what happened. And that happened because the State Department of Education was saying, if you don't open school sooner, we're going to penalize you financially. And the school districts ultimately decided it wasn't worth it to risk the possibility of losing tens of millions of dollars. And that's going to continue to be the conflict going forward. You mentioned the executive order from Commissioner Corcoran. So people always think of it as the executive order that says schools must be open, but it does a lot more than that. So basically it's saying that school districts have to have schools open as a choice, as an option for parents. And what it also did was say, if school districts make in-person classes an option, then the state will continue to fund them based on enrollment levels from before COVID-19. And we've seen huge enrollment drops in districts all over the state and all over the country. And so the difference is tens of millions of dollars.
Let me finish up on two more things here. I'm just wondering, like, what have you heard from teachers and or parents and students about, I mean, you got some students in class, some students at home, some are quarantined, those who get sick, you got to replace those teachers. I mean, are kids really getting an education right now?
Well, kids are definitely getting an education. They're not getting the same quality education in many cases as they were before COVID-19. And there are some mixed things I have heard from parents who said, you know, at first online learning was really difficult for my child, but now they've, you know, really gotten used to it and adjusted. And now they seem to be thriving. And we want to make sure that continues to be an option going into next, you know, the spring semester. And then, you know, there's also continuing anxiety and stress from teachers and staff members about, you know, what's happening in schools, if all of the right things are happening to try to keep COVID-19 from spreading in schools. I should say this superintendent of Miami-Dade County, Alberto Carvalho, has said that the contact tracing efforts thus far have not shown that a school was the source of infection. So as far as we know, people aren't getting sick at school, but they're getting sick outside of school, and then they're bringing that virus to school.
And yeah, you know, I was curious if you've heard anything on this, because that's an interesting point. And I'll finish with this is Thanksgiving is next week. And you may have kids who are going to, you know, connect with family they haven't seen in a while. They may be spreading it that way. They may be getting it that way. And then they come back to school. Does the school talk about that? Can they talk about that with kids?
Well, that's certainly a concern. I'm not sure if teachers are talking to students about being careful around Thanksgiving. I would think they are, you know, in terms of even more broadly, just talking to them about being careful all the time. But the Thanksgiving holiday is definitely a concern. You mentioned that New York City decided to go virtual. I saw that also Denver schools decided to go virtual after Thanksgiving through the end of the Christmas break or the winter break. So that's something that maybe we'll see happen here as these conversations continue with medical experts around, should we take a break after Thanksgiving? We saw the same thing happen in the spring where colleges decided to extend their spring break so that students could quarantine after potentially traveling. A lot of colleges are planning to just skip spring break next semester and either start later or end earlier. So they don't have to take that risk of students potentially traveling or going home and then maybe getting the virus and bringing it back to campus.
That was WLRN education reporter Jessica Bakeman. You could read more about Miami-Dade College's new president, Madeline Pumariega, and how public schools are responding to the coronavirus pandemic. Just go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, a Miami 8th grader's incredible story about race, climate gentrification, and how he's cleaning up his community. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, think about when you were a kid and all the things you wanted to be when you grew up. Maybe an astronaut, a football player, a firefighter, maybe an artist. Well, a new documentary follows the story of James Williams. He's a teenager in Miami, and his dream is to work in waste management. It explores his journey as a young black male making a difference in his community, overcoming traumas, and finding joy. The film is titled Negros. It will be showing at the Silver Spot Cinema in Miami starting tomorrow and over the next 2 weeks. And you can also watch it online through the Fort Lauderdale Film Festival. Check out our social media at WLRN Sundial for more details. Dorian Emerson Monroe is the writer and director behind the film, and he joins us now. Dorian, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You began this film as an investigative piece on how Martin Luther King Jr. Day is celebrated in Miami. And then, of course, we lead into meeting James. How did that lead you to James?
Yeah, initially, I was just really intrigued by the phenomena of how MLK Day is celebrated here in South Florida. It's definitely a spectacle, and sometimes it's depicted by the news negatively. And I sought out to kind of ratify those allegations. But I decided I didn't really want to do something so much focused on a movement, and I wanted it to be a little bit more character-driven. A few months later, I ended up meeting James randomly while I was having lunch one day, and he was riding by with a group of his friends, and I told him what it is that I was doing documentary-wise. And in collaboration with my producer and team, we want to be more character-driven. There's no doubt in anyone's mind that James would be the right person to tell this story through.
And you talk about, you know, that celebration. What that celebration is, I mean, you know, you have a lot of people who are riding bikes or motorbikes, four-wheelers, you know, as part of that celebration. And then here we see the story of James, and he's looking forward to riding his bike on Martin Luther King Jr. Day every year. I mean, he says, quote, it's like the Super Bowl, but, you know, this year, or there was a certain year that changed for him. And this is actually a clip from a film. This is James on the evening of that specific day.
After today, I don't know if I'm still going to ride bikes. I'm not interested. I used to be, like, excited, like, oh, yeah, let me try to do this, try to do that. I was just riding, mainly. I barely did tricks. I don't want to ride.
Okay, so all of a sudden, he's excited about it. It's the Super Bowl. Now he doesn't want to do it. What was it? Why did he change his mind?
Well, a few things. I mean, in 2019, MLK Day kind of changed forever when a hate crime incident occurred on the MLK bridge in Brickell. And it was tragic. I mean, this is something that's going to court and still hasn't been resolved. But that was a traumatizing moment for these young people as they had a gun pulled out on them and they were subjected to racial slurs. Despite that, they decided to get together and write again next year. But the police presence, I think, turned off a lot of people, especially James. I mean, think about trying to go out and ride your bike in unison with your friends and you got police on either corner of your street and a helicopter surveilling from on top. And I think a combination of those led to James no longer wanting to ride his bike. It's kind of a loss of joy. You know, I feel like our young people are growing up faster these days, and situations such as these kind of lead to that.
Tell us a little bit about James, where he lives, and how that's influenced who he is.
Yeah, James is an incredible individual. I mean, it's been a blessing to be able to work alongside him on this project. What I really like about him is he's a leader. Amongst his group of friends, they look up to him for direction, and he's going to go on to be a prominent figure in our Miami community. James currently lives in Liberty City. He's now a sophomore at Northwestern High School, and he has a lot of different passions. He really enjoys football. He really enjoys gathering with his friends. He's very educated. He reads a lot. I actually, over the pandemic, dropped off a couple books for him just because he explained that he has a joy for reading. And he really showed himself in this film. I mean, he went out of a way to make a change in his community, and I'm happy we're able to capture that and put it out there for the masses.
I mean, it's a fascinating story in how you even present the fact that, you know, a lot of young men in his situation, they think about what options do they have, you know, in trying to improve their lives. And he's choosing a path that you just wouldn't expect. But I wanted to, there was something else I wanted to move over to for a second. Journalist Mario Alejandro Ariza talks about Miami's history in the documentary and the role that that plays and why things are the way they are. Let's take a listen.
There was actual physical distancing enforced by the state. So you had a wall that was built in order to keep whites and blacks separate, two residential communities separate, because, you know, people believed, or the white folks believed at that time, that they shouldn't mix. The reason why this trash is there is because people from other parts of the city come in and dump their trash in Liberty City. And they dump their trash in Liberty City because there are at least 700 vacant and abandoned structures in Liberty City where people can dump their trash.
That wall is not physically there anymore, but why is it important to remember the historical context of it?
Well, actually, the wall still, to a certain extent, remains. The wall was put up in the 1930s, and originally the wall was 8 feet tall. Yeah. Somewhere in the 1970s, the wall was partly demolished, but 4 feet of that wall still remain today. There's actually a shot where James and his friends are straddling, walking on top of the wall as we present this information. And I felt for us to understand present day Miami, it's important for us to understand Miami's history. And that's why I was really excited to put that segment into the film. Mario is an incredible journalist and incredible author. He's actually the author of an amazing book called Disposable City.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful for his contribution to the film.
Yeah, and we had the chance to talk to him on the show about that book. Again, I'm speaking with Dorian Emerson. He's the writer and director of the film Negros. It follows the story of James Williams, a black teenager who wants to make a difference in his community and dreams of having a career in waste management one day. The film will be showing at the Silver Spot Cinema in Miami starting tomorrow over the next 2 weeks. And again, you can watch it online. Just go to our social media, WLRN Sundial, to get the details. In the film, there are a couple of intimate conversations between James and the people that he surrounds himself with. And one of those conversations is with his mother. And they're talking about what he should do if a police officer stops him. What does it mean to you to capture that moment? It's really powerful and sad, but I mean, I understood when I saw it why you did, but what for you, what was that moment like?
Well, it was over the summer, early summer, and we're in the midst of a racial revolution. And I wanted to bring people into the homes of these individuals that live in this certain neighborhood, because a lot of times, you know, we may drive by or we're on the 95 and we could look over, but we don't really know like what's going on in the home and what those discussions are like. And I felt like it's unique for James and for people of James's race. That's like a conversation that you have to have. And I don't know if everyone else is having that conversation.
When you were growing up, did your family have that conversation with you?
I didn't really have that conversation. No, I didn't. But I have a filmmaking technique that I call verite dialogue, where on a tripod, I have the camera, I hit record, and I just allow my characters that I'm working with to act like we're not here, act like the camera isn't here. We're going to roll the camera and kind of leave the room and just talk to your son how you would talk to him normally if we weren't here. And a few topics were discussed, but that was one of the topics that were discussed. And right away, we knew that was a very powerful moment.
You know, that's the other thing, too, is, you know, talking to filmmakers, when you go into somebody's home, I mean, you have to build some trust with them because you're asking them to open up their life to you. And I'm wondering, you know, what it was like when you approached James and his family and told them what you were going to do and what you wanted. What was that reaction like?
Yeah, it was very positive. Of course, initially there was a little apprehension. James's mom, Nicole, is very loving and caring of her children and protective. And she asked a lot of questions. It wasn't a right away process. I mean, it probably took about 2 weeks before we agreed to get started. But what I enjoy is that they trusted me. They believed in my vision. They saw how much it meant to me and how hardworking I was. I mean, I'm not backed by a big corporation or anything. This is pretty much just me and a small crew looking to make something happen. And In terms of James feeling comfortable with me, I didn't always film when I was with him. During the pandemic, I would stop by and bring like some Gatorade or some snacks and just to check up on him and see how he was doing. And it was through those encounters that I even discovered that he had a passion for waste management. So I think not only for myself, but just for other filmmakers, especially in a documentary form, to really build rapport with your co-collaborators prior to rolling the camera.
And I would say, you know, for folks to watch the film, because you have to understand, you know, where this young man is coming from, what he thinks and why he wants to do this. Again, I've never heard that. I've never heard a kid say, yeah, I want to go into waste management. But you got to hear that conversation, especially with his mother. And then, of course, later in the movie, what he's actually doing to clean up his neighborhood. Going back to his struggle with whether or not he wants to ride his bike during Martin Luther King Jr. Day, you know, and that's coming up in January. A lot has happened since that. You know, with the pandemic, social justice protests, the Black Lives Matter movement, the elections, everything. Do you think this MLK Day is going to be different for James, maybe for you?
Well, I feel like it'll definitely be different because of the civil unrest that we endured this year. I feel like a lot of people will want to show up and show their support and how proud they are for their culture and this historical icon. But with the pandemic, of course, distancing protocols may be at play. It'll be interesting to see how the police react. But I am excited for the holiday. I know James is looking forward to it as well. He actually got a dirt bike for a gift. A few months prior. So, you know, in that community, it's like a rites of passage. Like you start off on a bike, and once you master that bike, and as you enter your teenage years, you kind of graduate towards a dirt bike. And these young kids look at these kids on dirt bikes as like the heroes of the neighborhood. I mean, I remember I was at a protest earlier this summer, and when the gentlemen on dirt bikes showed up, they got a standing ovation. So I do kind of foresee that in James's future.
Wow. Well, good for him. And it'll be interesting to see what, you know, with everything that's happening, what it's going to be like this upcoming year. Dorian Emerson Monroe, again, writer, director behind the film Negros. It will be showing at the Silver Spot Cinema in Miami starting tomorrow. It's running for 2 weeks. Again, you can watch it online through the Fort Lauderdale Film Festival. Just check out our social media for more details at WLRN Sundial. You can also find the film on Instagram at Negros Movie. Dorian, it was just amazing movie, really fun story, but just an amazing story to tell of James, and I really do appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and Lewis, quickly, being that it's Give Day in Miami, I just want to really thank a lot of the nonprofits out there, especially the ones that helped out with this film, being Oolite Arts, Filmgate Miami, the Knight Foundation. this film wouldn't be possible without support from nonprofit organizations. And I know I say the same for a lot of artists in Miami. So thank you for having us on this show. And thank you to all the nonprofits out there that are helping people make a difference.
That's a great way to end it, and a great reminder to folks of what today is. Thanks again, Dorian. It's such a pleasure.
Thank you. Take care.
And that is our program for this Thursday, November 19th. Sundial Senior Producers Chris Remington, Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Taryn Shepherd. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Sapka. And our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. And as always, never forget the interns. Saria Reimer is our intern. Our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Balo at gobalo.com. Well, coming up next week on the show, members of the Florida legislature met in Tallahassee this week ahead of next year's session. A number of members were unable to attend because they tested positive for the virus. We're going to learn about the state's plan to address the pandemic. Plus, next week is Thanksgiving. How are you planning to celebrate and do it safely? Will you be cooking at home or eating out? We'll have a panel conversation about how to approach Turkey Day the safe way. All of that coming up next week on the program. As always, find us online, WLRN.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful Friday. Have a great weekend. Stay safe. Be good to each other. Talk to you live again on Monday.